Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. As you who've listened to the podcast know, Mormon Matters tries to reflect upon current issues going on in Mormonism, but also to react to news events, and that's the case with this podcast tonight. We are going to share with you a couple of interviews with people about the passing of Sister Chaka Okazaki and Elder Marion D. Hanks. As many of you will know, but some of you who may not, Sister Okazaki was a beloved speaker and author within Mormonism, and it comes out of mostly the time period when she was in the General Relief Society president under President Elaine Jack and serving alongside Sister Eileen Clyde. And this presidency, which was from 1990 to 1997, is remembered, I think, very fondly by a lot of feminists within the church, a lot of people who said, wow, these were the sisters who got real with us, who took on the issues that we were dealing with in our homes and the struggle with the balancing family and work demands, as well as you'll learn, and we spend a bit of time in our interview on Sister Okazaki's head-on response to the issue of sexual abuse and healing from sexual abuse. And she was just a wonderful woman who had a great ability to talk to everyone and to deal with difficult issues, and yet to have everyone go away from them feeling still good and empowered and optimistic that there was a good way ahead. Elder Hanks is known for, I think, a lot of things, but he was known, I think, as a general authority for whom just the word Christian came about. He was the general authority responsible for not always having the church feel that it must emphasize missionary work. If it was to simply serve other people, that was the high calling. And if missionary purposes were met through that, that's fine. But Christian service, standing up for against injustice and different things like that were his hallmark. And he was a beloved teacher, and he had that soul of the philosopher-poet. And I think you'll enjoy learning a lot more about him. So in this podcast, rather than our typical roundtable, what you'll hear is two interviews. The first is an interview I conducted Monday with Sister Clyde, who was the second counselor in that Relief Society presidency. She spent some time with me from her home in Springville, Utah. She was just hours away from welcoming a whole bunch of family and friends who were going to come to stay with her for these few days between then and the funeral. You know, in general, let me just go ahead and say it right now. With Sister Okazaki and Elder Hanks, I think we meet those people in Mormonism that were just, I'm attracted to them. I'm attracted by the largeness of their soul, the clarity of their vision, that ability to sort of look at the perhaps ugly things or the things that when we're missing the forest because of particular trees or when things aren't moving as fast as we want. They were able to say all that and to see it and to still not lose their hope and their optimism. Krista Tippett has a line in her one of her books that these are the kinds of people who say yes and. Yes, I see that. Yes, I know that lots of bad things have been done in the name of religion, and I acknowledge those. I don't want to minimize any pain there. But then that second response is, and let me get up and add my goodness to the world today. Let me add my perspective. Let me add my service. And I think with Sister Okazaki and Elder Hanks, we have two examples of that, and I'm inspired by them both. So back to the format of the podcast. After our interview with Sister Clyde, I'll briefly introduce just a couple of pieces of information about Margaret Young and Darius Gray, who I interview about Elder Hanks. In the course of their conversation, they'll talk about a book series they did. They talk about a DVD that they did, and I'll stop and introduce that to you so you won't be lost as we go there. So again, thank you for listening. Thank you for your financial support. We encourage you to keep that up. But most of all, we're just glad that you're with us. And we love it when you go to the blog at mormonmatters.org and engage panelists. In this case, just engage the topic. I'll certainly jump in there when you might write something to me. But in this case, with Sister Okazaki and Elder Hanks, we'd just love to have your reflections on them, as well as perhaps anything that comes up in these two interviews. So again, thank you very much, and please enjoy. Thank you so much, Sister Clyde, for being on with me. I know you're busy. You've got lots of friends and everybody coming, and you're speaking at the funeral here in a few days. But Sister Okazaki has meant so much to so many people, and you are in that prime position to especially talk about her public role, certainly during the presidency in which the two of you served in the Relief Society General Presidency. But I also were hoping to get a good feel for her as a person and not just somebody who, just not a list of her accomplishments. So I'm hoping to interview you about your impressions of her just as an impactful presence when you're in the room with her and things like that. So tell me, I know you guys started to serve in the presidency together in 1990. Had you had any experience with Sister Okazaki before that?
No, I had never met Chieko before that day when we were called together, called one at a time by President Monson. And that was when President Benson was disabled. And President Hinckley was there also, but it happened to be President Monson who called us. And as we were called, the three of us, first individually and then together, it was the first that I had met Chieko. I had met Elaine at a couple of other formal occasions, but I didn't really know her at all either. And I think the remarkable part for me is that we bonded very quickly. And in many ways, Elaine deserves credit for that, because as the president, she worked with us as a presidency almost every day when all three of us were in town, and we had a very much more extensive and active leadership traveling role than the people have now, that our sisters in Relief Society have now in the general level. So Chieko and I would have to say, just hit it off from almost the first moment. And as we worked together the first week and then the second week, because I was absolutely new to the general level of the church, Chieko had been there, and she'd been on the primary board when she was called. But we just found that we had much in common. We happened to have been born the same year. But I was born before she was, and she often called me her older sister. Another thing that neither of us had sisters, neither of us had daughters, and we kept saying, what are we doing here? We don't know what we're doing. So perhaps it was that discovery that we both worked so much on and then worked together that brought us together so much together personally.
Well, that's wonderful. Tell me, so what is it about, I mean, besides those connections that you were talking about, just what captivates people by Sister Okazaki when you first meet her? What just that flavor of her life and her spirit that just that leaves that impression that makes her so warm and ready to embrace?
She certainly is that, but my experience with her, you suggested that there was a public and a private Chieko, and in a sense, that is true, because her public presentation was always so encompassing, and people felt that they knew her from having heard her, even if they hadn't actually met her, and that was one of her great gifts. But as we went forward in our relationship as the counselors, Chieko and I tend to be quite analytical. I would like to use the word critical, but it has a negative connotation. And she was quick to analyze, and I welcomed that. So that was one of the first things that we saw. There were so many things we saw to do at that time, but the most important was to draw from the Sisters of the Church what was going on as the Church was growing very rapidly throughout the world. And Chieko and I were the ones who sat down together and then brought to Elaine many of the ideas that we had. She, of course, had her own, and together we would make decisions about what we did. But that's all I mean about Chieko's public and personal persona, and that is that she, in my relationship with her, was quick to analyze, a very good thinker, and as time went by, we developed a very wonderful friendship.
That's wonderful. The three of you as a presidency, I don't know that anyone's ever, you know, perhaps way go back to the early church to have such an influential presidency of the Relief Society. And you talk about you analyzed the data, or at least you gathered from the sisters what the issues were. But I think you can add the flavor to this, but most people would say you're the presidency that really said, let's not beat around the bush. Let's deal with real problems, even if it means that there's sort of a parting the veil that, say, Mormon women are experiencing these issues just the way it's going on in society. What brought you guys together to where you guys just were so honest and straightforward?
I don't know how to answer that. I do that we felt, when I say I don't know what brought us forward, that first month or so, repeatedly, Chieko and I would say to Elaine, how in the world did I get here? Because we were bringing things, you know, that she would certainly be willing to consider, and she was very careful about how she responded to us, but she finally told us that she had sought for days. She had been called earlier, was told not to tell anyone except her husband, and yet she was to propose counselors. And she said, I didn't have anyone really to talk with about it, of course. And she said, I had lists of names of women, any one of whom could have done this, because she had been on the general level for a long time. She'd been in Barbara Smith's board, and then she'd been a counselor to Artie Kapp in the Young Women. And so she did know many, many, and she said, I would pray over those lists. And she said, in due time, there were two names. And one, mine had been suggested to her, I don't know by whom. She had just added it to her list. It wasn't for this purpose. Anyway, she said, you're just here. You're here because of the Lord. I was inspired to call you. And believe me, it was an interesting, you know, binding together. That of course, did a lot. But the fact that we just were able to be ourselves. We did not, and we never tried, to be anything different from the way we were, and that worked for the three of us together. So that's the only answer I have for that, except that the general priesthood advisors told us, now this was in early 1990, they told us that by March of 1992, we needed to have devised a way to observe the sesquicentennial of the founding of Relief Society. And, you know, that gave us a very important purpose. But as we did that, we wanted that sesquicentennial to be meaningful in Africa and in the Philippines and in South America and in Canada and in New York. And that was what I thought brought us together very quickly. It caused us to seek information. We had focus groups. We did all kinds of things when we went, besides do leadership training. When we met those assignments, we always set aside time, each of the three of us, we never traveled together, to listen to the sisters. And what we brought back, what we had heard, was every bit as important to us as what we had prepared and taken to the women. And I think the focus on sesquicentennial and our sense of needing to know what would be received and how it would be received in the wards and branches and stakes of the church was the thing that helped us with that larger focus, but at the same time, a real goal, and we had to accomplish a great deal in that length of time, and we were given great freedom to do that. Almost everything we suggested was okayed, and we were able to go forward.
Well, that's wonderful, and you did, and for listeners to this show, well, first of all, why don't we just, because the focus is mostly on Chieko, she's certainly more than either of you because of a talk that she gave that she then recorded and was a best-selling tape through Deseret Book and things like that. One of these mm-hmm. issues that apparently had come up during your fact-finding or whatnot led her to speak in 1992 was sexual abuse and specifically healing from sexual abuse. And she took that head-on in some forthright ways. But what is it that, what was her startling message that felt so fresh and wonderful to listeners about this healing from sexual abuse issue?
Well, Chieko and I had discussed this to some extent, and just in our offices, I'd be in hers or she'd be in mine. I had just, at the time I was co-chairing a ritual abuse task force for the Utah State government. And we had heard now over a year of almost an 18-month period, we were hearing many women coming forward, at first through their counselors would refer them or just say to them, if you want to talk to this task force, it was such a hidden thing, it was so secret. And as I talked with Chieko about what we were learning, then she began in her, as she went out to do her leadership training, she would mention it, not in her leadership speeches, but in talks and smaller groups of LDS women. And then she would get letters back. And she said, I had no idea the extent of this. And she said, no one is addressing it. And I said, Chieko, I'm very hesitant to address it for fear it would be seen kind of political by me because I had that role. And so it was, she said, well, if this is going on, I'm willing to address it. She went up to the Northwest and gave a speech to that we were meeting with the priesthood leaders, that would be the bishops and stake presidents, and the Relief Society leaders, stake and ward. And we always insisted on working or meeting together with priesthood leaders and Relief Society leaders, so that each was hearing what was being said and would listen to one another, which they did. But that first talk of hers in that setting evoked so many questions from the people there, many of them quite aghast that there would be such problems, perhaps unknown. And so she came back and said, you know, I don't know what's going to happen from this, but I'm going to be more public with this discussion. And her persona, her abilities, her gifts made it just right, because she was not condemning anyone, but illuminating a matter that needed to be thought about. And then I was on a committee within the church on the high level to investigate these things and to be of assistance to priesthood leaders when people came forward to them. Many of the priesthood leaders did not know what to do, and many were in places where there were no other resources. And, you know, the law to require ecclesiastical leaders to report this sort of thing was enacted subsequent to 1990 in Utah, and it was in many other places also. But there was work within the church, and Chieko was working as through Relief Society to address this issue. It was just her particular, I call it a gift, because she could talk, as I say, about something very difficult and speak not only to the people who needed to hear her, and there would be people in every audience that said, she's talking about me, but it would also inform people who had no idea what she was talking about. And it certainly, I think, strengthened and helped priesthood leaders. It was subsequent to that, at our urging, that there was a hotline set up. And at first it was set up so that victims or people who had suffered things could call in to get help. But within a year or shortly, that was changed to a short line or a quick line for priesthood leaders, so that when they had someone come to them, they could get advice very quickly about how best, that is, first of all, to tell the person how to tell the law. But if they did not tell the law, then the priesthood leader needed to. And then if they were in a place where there was professional counseling available, the church urged that that be advised, as well as continuing ecclesiastical counseling. So that was a big thing. And Chieko was the one who was out front in dealing with it effectively.
Yeah, she sure was. And what you just mentioned there, in some ways, it wasn't it even quite startling at that time for her to just straight out say, you probably can't heal from this or regain the trust that's been taken from you through prayer alone, through counseling. You need professional help. You know, please seek it. So not only advising the church leaders to tell them that, but the victims itself. She was so forthright about how long this process can be. It just felt like a real sense of, let's get real about this. Let's be open. Let's open the windows and let the sunshine in on this, so we can deal with it forthrightly. And I know that she was, you know, kind to recognize that certainly often abusers are abuse victims themselves. But you know, we cannot be shielding the perpetrators of these things. We're not helping them and stuff. So anyway, I just loved revisiting that here in the last day or so, of just her message and how strong and forthright it was.
One of the interesting things you might think was that Chieko was perhaps the most surprised of all. I mean, she would come to me and say, look at this letter. This morning I had this phone call. She was just amazed at what her early talks on that subject evoked. She had no idea that these things had gone on. I had listened to people who had had this experience and were very damaged and had had very little validation for their life experience. And I was quite aware of that, but I was, and I addressed it too. But Chieko was the public picture, and she was so effective. When people left those meetings, they were not discouraged. That is, you know, that's a hard thing to talk about. And if you don't do it in a certain way, the people who didn't know what was going on or ever happened were upset. She had a way of talking about it, so it felt like it was unifying. We all have a role in acknowledging our life experiences and making them positive and going to the Lord about them and going to the Lord's servants about them, but you do not be silent about them.
And that reminded me just what you said there. We all have a role. We all have a place. That's where her wonderful metaphors of the cat's cradle.
It was the universality that Chieko had in her approach to every subject she ever talked about. It was, and her wonderful ability to use simple things. She often used them as just symbols, but they spoke everywhere. That's a unique talent, to be able to choose something that even if you've never worked on a quilt, as she would talk about the importance of the pieces of the quilt and putting it together and the work it took in the sisterhood, everyone felt, even the priesthood leaders, felt part of that.
Oh, and that wonderful.
Was her great gift.
Yes, yes, yes. As a presidency, you guys were very forthright on the demands of work and family. You guys addressed blended families. You addressed, probably in some of the earliest, real head-on addressing of homosexuality. Is there any stories you'd love to share about just you guys deciding to go into those things? And then I do want to talk a little bit at the end about Chaco and her ability to address racism. But I would just love to hear more about just some of these other broader issues that the presidency addressed and anything you'd share about those.
Well, I don't have any real stories, but I can tell you how carefully we worked together with our board, and we had a very talented board, well-educated, and I mean in life experience as well as in academic institutions, and we really called upon information and resource arm of the church. They came and told us we were the only people that ever asked them anything, and they had reams of data, so we would use that information. Each of us, all of us, as we developed what we did as we went out individually to do our what we called leadership training. But it always included several phases, and it was in those smaller groups of Relief Society leaders and members sometimes, it was always decided on the local level how those meetings came together, that we were able to address these different things. I don't think Chieko ever used the word racism. I could be wrong. I haven't
heard. Very, yes, interesting.
But she had a way of talking about it from her own experience that every one of us would reflect, oh my goodness, I wonder if I feel that way about thus and thus. And that so that was one thing that was addressed by simply telling her story. She used her life experiences to illuminate these things. And so she could say, I knew nothing about sexual abuse. I'm as shocked as you are about it. But then she could talk about it. And when she would talk about how they had such a difficult time, Ed and she, when they came to Salt Lake City, finding a place to buy, they could rent. But when they were trying to buy a home, even in the ward where they were living, people would just say no. And that changed dramatically as people got to know Chieko, but there was still a lingering and very subliminal bias against Japanese people. And she recognized that. She has a wonderful story about how she got her first assignment to teach first grade in Salt Lake City. And they had two first grades, and all the parents wanted to sign their children up with the other teacher. And Chieko was told that she might only have 10 or 12 in her classroom. And she said that, consequently, on the first day, she wore a fuchsia dress with a flower in her hair and stood at her door. And by the end of the day, she had 30 children in
yep.
her. That was symbolic. It was symbolic. The children were entranced by her, and the parents who brought their children thought, oh, maybe. And that was the way she dealt with that. After she'd been told, you may not have a full classroom.
I appreciate hearing that, because in my reading this last week, I caught that story, but I didn't quite get the exact image of her standing at the door. She had talked about the mention of the dress and just her personality winning people over, but I hadn't quite gotten all that detail, so that's wonderful. I know you're going to speak at her funeral on Wednesday, and I'm going to release this podcast later that same day. As you've been, you know, combing through your heart and gathering things for your marks, and I don't want you to share anything that you want to keep just for that funeral moment, but what is the two or three qualities of Chieko Okazaki that still are so needed today that you would love to see developed and forefronted as Latter-day Saints, or just simply what does this society in this day and age need that she had with her?
The first thing that comes to mind is her forthrightness, and I'm speaking now in my personal relationship with her. She would come into my office more often than I went into hers, because she just come quickly. And anything that was concerning her or that she wanted to get a perspective on, we could talk about in moments, no time wasted, and it was forthright, the fact that we could share openly and honestly with one another, and really, because of that, be able to help one another. Now, interestingly, I saw that reflected in her public talks, her addresses, I like to call them. people felt almost an immediate trust. And she did not raise matters that caused people to feel about things controversially, but rather, I have an ally, I have a friend. And that was exactly what happened with us. So the first thing would be her forthrightness. I think the next thing I talk about would be her loyalty. That's not the best word, but it's the only one that comes to mind. She was a wonderful friend, and people who only met her or sometimes only heard her felt that also. And if they wrote to her, if they invited her, the best example is the missionaries that she and Ed had. The two examples I would cite would be the missionaries who kept in touch with her and would, as they became bishops and stake presidents, that was one of the reasons she had so many invitations beyond her leadership training, was through these priesthood leaders who wanted her to come and speak. And she gave so much of herself in order to be able to do that. The other group were her first and second and third grade students. And I would walk the streets with Chieko in many places, but mainly in Salt Lake City, and never once did we get back to the office without her seeing someone who said, "Oh, Sister Okasaki, do you remember that I was in your second grade class?" And she would pop with the person's name and their parents and which class. Yes, there was. Now, that's more than loyalty. But it is, she felt they were part of her family. She felt that way about the missionaries, and that was a mutual feeling. So that is a rare quality. And the more she did addresses and went to far-flung places, the stronger that became. Her loyalty to her sisterhood particularly, she cared deeply for the women of the church. She says that she would never have survived to her baptism if it hadn't been for the Hawaiian women who nurtured her, because she was 15 and she was then away from home. And that was a very, very strong allegiance. But it's more personal than allegiance is. So those are the two qualities. You know, the other people, we could cite many, but those are personal qualities that were coming across. I happened to be with her on Monday afternoon, with my husband, whom she thought a great deal of. That was one of the bondings that took place with her and me, was that my husband and Ed really hit it off too. And my husband was supervising construction projects in rather far-flung places, both in Utah and other places. And because we were away a lot of the time, Jaco and I, Hal would call Ed and he would take him on some of these trips. And so that's the way they got to know each other so well. And then when Ed died so suddenly, that bonded us also to be together. So we had that in common, and it was one of the very important parts of our experience together.
Very, very neat. I can't even imagine. I just loved hearing all of that. Thank you so much. The one thing that came up for me that I wasn't planning or I hadn't thought to ask until you said that, I'm wondering, when you say the word loyalty, and you explained that that wasn't always adequate, and you enriched it through these personal bonds, there is an issue of loyalty to the church. And it just reminded me that maybe I would love to know if you remember or recall anything that certainly said to Chieko, this is the church, and despite, you know, it being slow or, you know, not always reactive or not always definitely proactive, what is it that just centered her in the gospel and just allowed her to always want to still stick with it and honor leaders or people that would frustrate her or anything like that? So I don't know if I phrased that well, but if there's anything along that line of just her spiritual motivation within the church that you could speak to.
Well, that is the only point I'm going to try to make on Wednesday, because there will be five speakers and each of us have 5 minutes. Chieko's baptism, her process, and she's talked to me about it many times, partly because Hal's brother, Grant, was one of teams of missionaries who taught her when she was 15.
Oh, my.
And before she was, and so that's one of the reasons she spent, from time to time, would talk to me about that period. She had just left her little tiny village because they had lost their school there, and in order to continue her classes, she had to get to Kohala. And it was far enough away, so there was no way to get there unless she went there to live. And then she, with some friends, saw a notice about the missionaries inviting people to come and hear them, and she got her friends to go with her. And she said as time went by, friends kind of dropped out, but she stayed. But she had so many questions. It was a very searching experience for her. But the answer to it is that as I've thought about this a great deal myself, and I'm not using this word on Wednesday, but Jacob's conversion was by the Holy Spirit and was as miraculous as anything I've ever seen. And the strength of her testimony, which she bore in so many public places, not churches, was absolutely salient in her life. And it is what kept her going when, after Ed died so suddenly, she met every assignment she had. We all tried to relieve her of them. She said, no, I must keep doing what I was doing. And it was both a way of dealing with her grief, but it also came from her deep-seated belief that she was a disciple of Christ and that she had things to do because of that. So that, for me, is, I've thought about it a great deal. She has talked to me about it a great deal. But her conversion was complete from Buddhism, which she had observed in the ways that it was in her village, to Christianity, but more powerfully to the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. And it was her strength the whole way. She was able to marry Ed, even though he was not a member. And she understood the implications of that, but she was so respectful of his belief, and she never once made conditional she would do this if he would do that. She let him find his own way, and he began going to church just because she went every Sunday, and he wanted to see what she was doing. And then he became converted, and he was very similar to that, but Chieko's conversion was complete and was guided and brought about by the Holy Spirit, and she never, ever lost the feel for that and could express it in ways that uplifted people that hardly understood what she was talking about.
Thank you. And I promised you I wouldn't keep you very, very long, and I know you're extremely busy. But on behalf of the Mormon Matters audience, which is growing and is significant and is an audience that, for the most part, is aware of difficult issues and yet are fearlessly fighting to find their home within Mormonism, to develop qualities of thinking and of heart and approach that allow them to be comfortable here. What you've just shared about Chieko, and just hearing you speak too, we need to interview you sometime. I'll bug you another day for more of an Eileen Clyde focus. But thank you so much for sharing what you have about Chieko Okazaki. I know she's someone that many, many people loved, and you've got to be sad, but also sweet at this moment.
Yes, yes. Well, I really appreciate this opportunity, and I'm particularly interested in your audience. So at some other time, let's have a visit.
Okay, let's have a visit, and thank you, and all my blessings as you speak and as you unite with friends here this week.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye.
I hope everyone enjoyed that interview. It was certainly a wonderful experience for me to chat with Sister Clyde. And it was interesting. After we hung up from our interview, she called me right back to make sure that I knew of a connection between Sister Okazaki and Elder Hanks. And that was that while he was serving in the military and was stationed in Hawaii for quite a while, he and Chieko got to know each other as friends and colleagues in the ward there. She was apparently his Sunday school teacher. And then it was interesting in the little bio sketch that accompanied her funeral program today, it mentioned there that Elder Hanks would often talk about how it was Chieko Okazaki who taught him the Book of Mormon and helped him gain a great love for it. So that was a neat connection, and there's actually another connection or two that come up in the interview that follows. And for this interview, as I mentioned earlier, I speak with Margaret Young and Darius Gray. For those of you who don't know Margaret, she is an award-winning author. She's written short stories, plays, collections of essays. They seem to always rise to the top. She's a dynamic personality. You'll get to know her and her just great love and capacity for joy. And she is with her partner of the last 13 years, Darius Gray. And by partner, I mean partner in writing books about the Black experience and also producing a documentary. They were introduced 13 years ago at a Sunstone Symposium. Darius was inspired to ask Margaret to partner with him in telling these stories of Black pioneers, early Latter-day Saints, and taking the story up to the present day. They worked on those, and one of the results of it was a 3-volume book of historical fiction, and it's a book series called Standing on the Promises. And then book 3, which is the one that takes us really up in the modern day, Elder Hanks appears as a character in the story of Len and Mary Hope, and you'll hear that story a bit in the podcast interview that we're about to play for you. Another character in that story is Darius Gray. He joined the church back in the 60s. He, you know, knew about the priesthood restriction, felt a strong compulsion to still proceed with his baptism. He's been a force, a mighty force within Mormonism. He was a longtime president of the Genesis Group, which is a group that's formed to support Black Latter-day Saint. And he's a wonderful, dynamic person whose voice you'll hear and love. It's just this gorgeous broadcaster's voice, which is what his early career was. And we're so grateful to have both of them here. So the book series that they're talking about is Standing on the Promises. And then they also mentioned a DVD that they produced called Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons. And it is a wonderful DVD. I know you can pick it up for about $20. I saw it at Benchmark Books the other day. If it's more expensive online, give Benchmark a call. It's a fantastic documentary. A shorter version of it has been starting a 2-year run on the documentary channel, which hopefully your cable provider has. It's already aired once, but it's scheduled to air again on August 18th at 8 and 11 p.m. I believe that's Eastern times. Two other dates that it's scheduled to play there are September 25th and October 17th. So keep those in mind if you'd like to see it that way. But I do really recommend buying the DVD for all the special features. I'm grateful for Margaret and Darius getting on the phone with me for this interview. It does concentrate on the intersection of Elder Hanks with Blacks and the priesthood, but there's plenty in here to give you that sense of his warm, loving spirit, his generous soul, and his great faith. And it was just a really wonderful interview that I think you'll enjoy. Margaret Young and Darius Gray, I'm so grateful to have you on the show and to talk about someone who I know is very close to you, both lives intersecting-wise, as well as just as a spiritual mentor and somebody that you admired very much. And I really appreciate the chance to engage you and help our listeners get a feel for this man. Darius, if you don't mind me starting with you, can you tell me the first time you met Elder Hanks and what your first impressions were, and then we can get a little bit to later impressions after that?
Oh, we're immediately in trouble, aren't we? Asking an old man to remember back when. It was when I was relatively new to the church, and obviously then relatively new to Utah. And I don't have a firm memory of a particular date or time. I remember meeting him, and he seemed pleasant and all, but for me at that point, I was very, very cautious. I did not know who was friend or foe. And so one of the sad points for me is that was the circumstance for me back then. And I think it would have been grand to have embraced him and to have had him embrace me more thoroughly in those days, but I was sort of standoffish. So I just would have to go back and say it was probably around 1968, somewhere in there, and just that vague time period in memory.
And when did you decide that he was friend? Do you have any thoughts or you know what you know little incidents or how did it grow into the warmth
it
that
did.
You felt?
And there is a Vietnam veteran support group that he was a part of, VASA, and I was invited to be sort of the host of a program on which he was going to be the speaker. And so I was master of ceremonies, in essence. And so I had a chance to interact with Elder Hanks more at that point. And that would have moved forward in time, you know, a couple of decades. And therefore, we knew of one another, and I had a greater appreciation of who he was and what he had done, having watched him over the years, with no particular single point to point to. But that event, being there as the master of ceremonies, the host, whatever, for that event with VASA, was important. We had a chance to chat. And I knew myself better by then. I knew who Elder Hanks was, which is the significant point, who he was and his legacy in the church.
Great. Thank you so much. And Margaret, what about you? When did you first encounter him, either as somebody you were reading or impressed with from afar or personally?
I loved him from afar as a young person. You know, I'm in my 50s, and so I have strong memories of him as a young general authority, a little bit older than I, but didn't meet him until Darius and I were working on our third book. And I wrote to someone told us, actually, we looked at the oral history that Alan Cherry and Jesse Embry had done, that was done with Elder Hanks. And I've always been really, he spent the last years of his life in a place for people with dementia. And so they always called him deaf, and I never did that. He always was Elder Hanks to me, so I will continue to refer to him that way. But we became aware of the Len Hope story through the oral history, and so I wrote Elder Hanks a letter. I just found him in the phone book in Holiday and wrote and asked if we might talk to him about Len Hope. And he sent me the letter back with a handwritten note with this phone number, saying, "Sure, call me, and we'll arrange a time." And that was when Darius and I went over together. It was the first of six or seven times that we met with Elder Hanks. We went to his condo, and he told us the Len Hope story and other stories as well. We had I just started reading everything I could about Elder Hanks and found that there was not nearly enough about him, and wondered why nobody had done a biography, and hope that gets done. But I read everything I could, including many of his talks and certainly the history with Len Hope and other times where Elder Hanks had developed quite a reputation of being one who would stand up for anyone who was not being treated with charity. And so with that knowledge, Darius and I met with him, and he basically took us through the condo and started pulling books off his shelf, saying, "Oh, you'll need this. This will do you good." There was a book by Widso that I believe Darius now has in his basement that was his own Witsa's investigation.
Trees of Living Light, I believe it was.
But it's a typewritten, I think it's like the only one, typewritten Witsa's own investigation into the priesthood restriction and its history. And it was a pretty thorough piece. But just one thing after another, and then we asked him, of course, to tell us the Land Hope story. And we'll let Darius start that. This is one of Darius's favorite stories to tell, so I'll let him.
I'll just start with a part, and then Margaret, invite you to jump in. First of all, the listeners need to hear that Lynn Hope and his wife, Mary, were Black Latter-day Saints. And I believe that Brother Hope was born, about 1892, he served, before he served as a soldier, I started to get into that, and let me not jump ahead, but at one point really had this urge to know which of all of the churches were correct, or was correct, and it's reminiscent of the Joseph Smith story. And he had explored various churches, and finally he settled on joining the Baptist Church. But he said, and I can pull his words up here shortly, that, just after joining, the Spirit came to him and told him that he wasn't in the right church. He needed to be baptized all over again. And so he went on a personal search. Found an old broken-down building out in a field, and he went in to pray. And he said he was going to stay there until, he had an answer of what is the Holy Ghost and how do you receive it, because one of the ministers with whom he had talked had indicated that you can know the truth of all things by the power of the Holy Ghost. And so certain other ministers said, well, you get the Holy Ghost immediately after joining a faith. And others had indicated that he had to do all sorts of strange things. Finally, he just settled, I'm going to go out and pray for the gift of the Holy Ghost. And he said it was as though he was getting himself in ashes and sackcloth, presenting himself to God on, bended knees. And so he was searching for that as he was out in the woods. And Margaret, I'll let you pick it up from there.
He went and found a little shack, an abandoned shack, and started having prayer. We describe it in book 3 of our trilogy, Standing on the Promises. And I'll tell you why we know the exact words when Darius is saying what it was like for him. Elder Hanks recorded Len Hope's testimony in 1945. So we have his own words, Len's own words, that we drew on to depict everything that we did in our books. And then in Special Features of Nobody Knows the Untold Story of Black Mormons, we use the recording that Elder Hanks provided. So he was Len Hope, and this is pre-World War I, so we don't get confused with when it was recorded and when it happened. So this is probably 1912-13, before World War I, he's praying and decides that he maybe should say that I'll stay here and to get an answer, to receive the Holy Ghost until I die, and then reconsiders and thinks that his mother would be upset if he were to die in some little shack somewhere. And so just stays on his knees and prays all day and all night, and then feels that the answer will be given to him, and then returns home. And in Len Hope's words, he says, we had never had the missionaries out here. They didn't have sidewalks leading up to the house. There was just corn. So no place for anybody to walk. And it was a black part of, it was in Magnolia, Alabama. Mormon missionaries did not venture into black neighborhoods, and to venture to a place where there was no sidewalk would be really not anything expected. But within just a few days of that remarkable prayer that Len Hope offered, two missionaries came to the home and delivered a tract, gave it to Len's sister. And Len, the sister said to Len, some preachers brought these for you. And Len said, I wonder how she knew that they were for me. And it was tract, I believe, by Witsa again, that was the Holy Ghost, who it is and how to receive the gift. And Len immediately went to find the missionaries
and wanted to be baptized. I'll just make a long story short. They suggested that he read about the church first before he was baptized. He went off to World War I, came back and was baptized, was actually threatened by Knight Riders that unless he got his name scratched off the records of the church, they would take his life. And he just went to the church members and asked what to do, and they said, "Why, Len, this is just persecution of the devil. We all go through this. You do what you want, but your name is on the record of the Lamb of God." So he did not get his name taken off. And then he married Mary. They moved to Cincinnati and encountered tremendous racism, where the branch president, after a council with others, and Darius can give some insight because he met a man who participated in that, decided that Len and his family, being African-American, should not participate in LDS services. Darius, do you want to tell about when you met that person who participated in
the council? I met the now senior son of the man who was that branch president. And that son recounted and recalled the story. And at first, as we were talking, having some background on it, I knew that maybe he was hesitating a bit, and I let him go ahead and tell the story, and I said, "Well, let me give you what I've heard." And I shared with the son of what I had heard, and he said, "You are correct," and he had tried to sanitize it. But basically, in those days, apparently the sacrament water was from a single cup. There weren't individual little plastic cups as we have today. And the white members of the branch were deeply troubled by having to drink from the same cup as this black couple, Len and Mary Hope. And so they had approached the branch president and been successful, and the branch president called the Hopes in and told them that it was going to be preferred that they not attend church any longer, that it was uncomfortable for the white members there. And in the telling from the Len Hope side and from the son, now a grown man, the details came the same. In that interview with the branch president, once the Hopes had been informed that they would not be allowed to come to church, the only comment was, "Can we still pay our tithing?" There wasn't anger, there wasn't argument. They just wanted to know if they could still pay tithing. And so the answer was yes, and arrangements were made for the missionaries to take sacrament out to the Len Hope family on a regular basis. Was it monthly, Margaret?
Yes, it was every fast, the first Sunday of every month.
Every fast Sunday. And it was on one of those occasions that the next beautiful part of the story involving Elder Hanks comes into play.
And he was one of those missionaries who administered the sacrament to the Hope family. We talked to several missionaries who had that experience, and they talked all about homemade ice cream that Mary Hope would make, and a barbecue, and singing of hymns. The Hopes were wonderful singers. The whole family sang, and Elder Hanks participated in all of this, and then one day became ill while he was at the Hopes' home and had a bad sore throat, and Mary refused to let him go home. She wanted to take care of him. So he remained, and the other missionaries left, and for several days, Elder Hanks, Mary and D. Hanks, stayed there at the Hope family, and Mary, he talked about Mary just soothing his forehead, wiping his forehead, and he said, "I never knew the color of the hand." And he and Len talked about the priesthood restriction, and Len had his own ideas of why it was in place. I believe he felt that whites simply weren't ready to accept blacks. And the friendship formed during the time of Elder Hanks' visit, his stay with the Hopes, endured for the rest of Len's and Mary's life. When Elder Hanks, this young missionary, was ready to leave after several days there, it had been snowing outside, and his district leader was waiting in the car, and he stepped down the steps and waved to the Hope family, and then was taken away. And the Hopes told him later that Mary went to get a broom to sweep the steps, and Len stopped her and said, "Mary, I've treated you like a lady all of our married life, but don't you sweep those steps. Don't you know what the Bible says? How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace. Because in the little trace of snow on the steps were Elder Hank's footprints.
It's beautiful. Yes. Yeah, I'm tuning back in. I read your book 6 or 7 years ago, and this is so wonderful to have that recounted. But extraordinary missionary, and obviously they caught the spirit of him, as well as just the fact, I guess it could have been any member there. But don't you recount other experiences with Elder Hanks related to the issue of blacks in the church, and especially those pre-priesthood days?
Well, there was one where, as Margaret knows so well, Elder Hanks was on an assignment to Louisiana. And in that situation, his reputation did precede him. Margaret?
He had a reputation of one who would not suffer inequality. And there was a black man seated in what Elder Hanks called Third Heaven, way up separate from all of the whites. This was at a state conference, and Elder Hanks was presiding as a general authority. And he looked at the man and looked at the state president and said, "What's he doing up there?" And the state president said, "Elder Hanks, your reputation precedes you. I know what you're thinking. And let me tell you, if you invite that man down, I'll stay. But I guarantee my counselors will leave and everybody in this conference will leave." Elder Hanks just went up on his own and talked to the young man who was in the military, and not LDS, but was just curious about the LDS faith. He chose not to disrupt things, understanding that probably there really would be a scene, but just extended his own personal welcome to this man. But as we understood it, and this was from Elder Hanks' own mouth, there were so many general authorities who really were flummoxed when the priesthood restriction questions came up, as they inevitably did. And Elder Hanks became kind of the go-to guy. He was the temple president for the Salt Lake City Temple, and missionaries would approach him and say, "How do we answer this question?" There was a time where a whole group of kids had come from Arizona, I believe, a choir, and they had their lodgings arranged, but there was a black kid who was in the choir, and the hotel was not going to let that child be with them. And as I recall, Elder Hanks had the child stay at his mother's house. Elder Hanks had had a friend, a black friend. I think we've got his name in our book because Elder Hanks told us the story several times, and how one time the two of them were playing, and Elder Hanks went to get a glass of water before the friend, and his mother said, "Now, Duff, company goes first." And Elder Hanks said, "Ah, he's not company, he's just," and then gave the name. But he had grown up in a home where equality had been honored, and that was something that was his legacy and something that he passed on and something that he felt strongly about. When he was in the Silverado, where he spent the last years of his life, Darius and I took a picture of Len and Mary Hope there. The last time we visited, which was just a couple of months ago, that picture was still there with pictures of him with missionaries who had served under him when he was mission president in Great Britain, including Elder Holland and Elder Cook, I believe.
Right.
And pictures from his various times of service. Darius, any other stories from...
Well, I'm just happy to say that the legacy continues of Marion D. Hanks. The audio tape that he recorded of Len Hope in 1947, he gifted to us and will be part of our papers that we submit for archives. Also, the pictures of the Hopes, Len and Mary Hope, and a couple of their sons. We were gifted those by Elder Hanks. And so that history, that legacy of those early black members and of Elder Hanks's involvement with them will continue on. They won't be lost to history, and I'm so happy that that's the case. Additionally, at some point, Elder Hanks had received an assignment, I believe, from the Senior Brethren to do some research on the origins of the black priesthood issue, and he also gifted that to us. And so we have all of those works and efforts from days long gone by. and those obviously will be preserved as well.
And we should mention a couple of things. First of all, in 1978, before the Priest's Revelation was received on June 1st, 1978, now known as Official Declaration Number 2, and it was then presented, before it was presented to the church at large, it was presented to the general authorities, including Elder Hanks. And he was asked to respond to it. And he stood before his fellow general authorities and said, "I thank God that I live to see this day. I don't know if there's color in heaven, but if there is, I think I know who the first high priest will be," and named Len Hope. The other thing I want to mention is I believe that Darius received the last priesthood blessing that Elder Hanks gave before the illness became so serious that he had to go to the Silverado. And that was a sweet and precious experience. I think the listeners are probably aware that Darius has some health issues, fairly serious ones, and Elder Hanks knew about them. That was probably because I had told him.
I wasn't going to mention that, but I had a hunch. The truth will out. The truth will out.
You guys are too funny. I love you guys. Together. It's just hilarious.
We were at Elder Hanks' condominium and had, you know, as I said, we met with him a number of times to get all of the stories and make sure we had everything right. And this was our last time at meeting with him there. Then all of our other meetings were when the dementia had really started taking effect. And then from then on, we would go to the Silverado and see him there. But the last meeting in the condominium, Darius and I were ready to leave and heading for the door, and Elder Hanks said, "Wait a second, Darius, don't we need to take care of some business?" And Darius, if you remember better than I, please interrupt and tell it.
No. I'm laughing.
Shall I continue?
It's such a sweet, tender moment. Go ahead.
Yeah. And Darius turned and... Darius tends to call people sir or ma'am. He was raised that way. He even calls me ma'am periodically. Although I'm so much younger than him, but it's really weird. But he said, "Sir," and Elder Hanks said, first of all, Elder Hanks took a chair and just turned it around and said, "You need a blessing, don't you?" And I hope I can get the words right, and please correct me if I don't, Darius. I believe that Darius said, "I would be very pleased to receive a blessing from you, Elder Hanks." And then he sat in the chair, and it was interesting, Elder Hanks told me exactly where to stand, and it was though I was being included in the circle. He recognized our friendship and the companionship in what we were doing in this work, that we were, you know, we considered ourselves missionaries and telling these stories, and Elder Hanks was a vital part of what we were doing. And then he pronounced that blessing on Darius and instructed him that there was yet much for him to do. The last time, Darius and I visited him 2 months ago. I visited Elder Hanks with my family, maybe it was just my husband, several months ago, probably 6 months ago. And at this point, his recognition was not terribly good. And remind me to tell the story about when Elder Hanks saw our documentary. I think maybe we can even close with that. But I was kneeling by Elder Hanks' bedside, and his hand was a little bit shaky, and he kind of would put it on a head or whatever to stable it. And I just was looking deep into his eyes, hoping that he would recognize me, because he had often in the past. You know, he'd call me by name and call Darius by name. And his hand was just near to my chin, and I just thought, "Oh, Elder Hanks, I wish you could give me a blessing." And I actually needed a blessing. I was going through some things with my children. And then he just moved his hand on top of my head, didn't say anything, but just kept it there, just cradled my head. And I felt like we were moving beyond the limitations that the disease had put upon him, and that something spiritual was happening. And I felt like I was being blessed by Elder Hanks, even through the limitations.
Wow, that's gorgeous. Thank you.
I do want to hear the story of him responding to the documentary. Do you mind if we go just a little bit broad as far as just some of the other themes that have been coming up in the obituaries and the various reflections on blogs and things? Just for the listeners who haven't had a chance to read those, one of the things that it seems like it always comes up, it certainly was the focus of the Tribune's coverage with Peggy Fletcher Stack, and that was his being so instrumental in really convincing the brethren that we didn't always need to have a missionary focus on everything we do, that Christian service was a much more powerful call to each of us, and it also still had that side effect of bringing affection or at least goodwill towards the church. Do you want to just echo just do something broader with that? Many people draw lines from that to the humanitarian arm of the church even coming into being. And I didn't know if you had thoughts or stories
that you could
share.
Let's let Darius, I think Darius ought to respond and then I will.
Well, I'll come with a more recent one. Within the last week, I was in a meeting, a church setting, and those sorts of thoughts and comments were being again discussed, whether we need to do some things and not have the proselytizing effort, you know, always, but just the surface effort. And yes, that is again a legacy, and it might broaden in the future. Those are not any decisions I'm a part of, but those discussions are still there. And so Elder Hanks was again ahead of his time, and that he understood that we could reach people so well, and just being loving neighbors, kindly reaching out. And part of that effort has been found when the church now sponsors family history gatherings around the country. And it is specifically arranged so that no proselytizing is done during those events. It's not for that purpose. It's to help people discover their own roots, to do their genealogy and family history. And in the beginning, of course, those who have a strong missionary bent, this is going to be great. We're going to have 200-300 people come here who aren't members of the church. We'll have the missionaries there and have them, handing out cards or Books of Mormon or whatever else. And that was strongly, discouraged and has now become practice. But again, to provide service, to be there, to be neighbors to others of the Father's children, and not always try to convert or present the information that might convert.
This is where we get a unifying of Sister Okazaki, who just died, and Elder Hanks, because both of them worked on the Ubavulusa, the Africa.
No. Olesubugu.
Olesubugu. The name is Sister Okazaki.
Yeah, it's spelled differently and starts with a Q, and it's a village in Mali.
Right, Africa, yes.
Africa. Sister Okazaki came to Genesis and had us repeat it several times so that we remembered, had somebody go get a drink of water from the fountain and then bring it to her and then say, see how easy that was? But in Africa, and then talked about the difficulties of going to the wells and how the church, how I know some missionaries have built wells, but humanitarian, just individual foundations have also participated. And Elder Hanks established his own foundation. In fact, sometimes we met with Elder Hanks in the foundation's office, which was by Temple Square. And that was one of the things that they did. He and Sister Okazaki both worked in that particular foundation. And I'll maybe do another bit of tattling. Elder Hanks and his wife, Maxine, were intimately aware of others' needs, and they loved Darius, especially Elder Hanks. It was very clear that he loved Darius and was extremely aware of Darius's health issues and concerned about them and concerned about, how expensive medications were and all of that. And so they apparently contacted Darius and said, we'd like to help out as we can. We know that the expenses are outrageous. And they weren't able to get much response, so they called me. And it was Maxine who called me and said, Margaret, we really want to help Darius with this, and we can't get him to agree, which is no surprise to me at all. But but it was just nobody. I wouldn't have known that, except that she was calling because she couldn't get a response from Darius. And I think we won't tell the end of that story because it's private. And if alms were done, we won't broadcast them. The Hankses themselves chose not to herald their good works, but I believe that is emblematic of how they lived their lives, that they were aware of any difficulty that others were having, whether they were in Africa or down the street in Midvale, that they were perpetually aware of how they could meet the needs of their brothers and sisters.
Let's wrap it up with the story on the documentary, Margaret.
Yeah. I'll start at Darius, and you got the call from, was it Richard Hanks who left your voicemail?
Yes.
So I'll start the story. We went to the Silverado one time and took our documentary with us after it had just recently been finished. And Elder Hanks was sleeping, so we just left it there with a note saying that Darius and Margaret were here to visit. Here's our documentary. And Darius, why don't you tell about the phone call you got?
No, go ahead, please.
Well, I believe it was first a voicemail. Was it a voicemail, or did you actually talk to, and I think it was Richard Hanks, Elder Hanks' son.
It was Richard Hanks.
And he was in tears. Was it voicemail or actual?
And I can't remember, frankly.
I think it was a voicemail where he was in tears. And Elder Hanks, you know, with the dementia, the recognition just gradually disappears, and it is so painful when somebody who you love doesn't recognize you or doesn't know you've been there, and the family had endured that, and they were so loyal. Sister Hanks was there every day with her husband and the children. So often when we would go, we would see Elder Hanks' children. But they put on the documentary, and Elder Hanks had kind of been out of it a little bit. But as soon as Darius's face came on, Elder Hanks said, "That's Darius." And as soon as my face came on, Elder Hanks said, "That's Margaret." And Richard just was in tears because this, you know, it was like he came to as he saw our images. That friendship and the bonds that we had brought him back to the present. And it was a sweet celebration of the bonds that we have.
It's beautiful.
Dear man, a dear friend, I'm grateful for the personal interactions with him, and more grateful even for his life as a whole, his contributions, not only to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but to humanity. He was a caring human, a loving son of God.
That would be a wonderful place to conclude. I'm going to add one other thing, and Dan can edit it out if he chooses to, because that was eloquent, Darius. I'll just say that because I took my children often with me to see Elder Hanks, and I woke my son up yesterday morning by saying, "Michael, Elder Hanks died." And Michael sat up and said, "Duffy?" And I said, "Yes, he died." Michael really loved Elder Hanks. I don't know what it was that... with the relationship, and he was also really proud to go show people the song "That Easter Morn" that Elder Hanks penned the lyrics to, and say, "I know the guy who wrote this." And people would say, "Oh, come on, you really know?" Yeah, well, we go visit him sometimes. It's Elder Hanks, and that's the last visit that Darius and I made to Elder Hanks. I sang him that song. Usually, he would sing with me. We would often sing when we would go. And usually he would start singing even if he hadn't been speaking much. This time he didn't sing along, but I sang him all three verses of "That Easter Morn" that he himself wrote, that speak of the resurrection and of his faith in it. And I'm fairly certain that it will be sung at his funeral. If it's not, I'll sing it afterwards.
And I'll join you.
I'll see you both there, and just thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast. You guys are
amazing friends and people who make my heart sing. And I know that Elder Hanks has played that role for you guys, and we're so grateful for what you shared.
Thank you, Dan.
We're grateful for you too, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you, my good friends. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.